I felt that the story, you know, we're reading the stories now in Genesis, the story of Joseph and his brothers. And I felt that perhaps we should do that because it really is, I think it's the most moving story in the Torah, and there's a lot of depth there that when the casual reader doesn't see. So we'll start with the... in the beginning, we start with actually chapter 37. If you're not familiar with the facts, somebody can interrupt me, and I will try to fill them in. We have the story where Joseph has these dreams, and he presents the dreams to his brothers. And you'll notice there were two dreams. One dream was the dream with the sheaves, and the second dream was the dream with the heavenly bodies, the sun and the moon and the stars, that they bowed down to him. And the reason why there were two different dreams is because the symbol of the sheaves was that he would have financial power over them. They bowed down to him because of his financial power. And the other dream, the second dream, the dream of the celestial bodies, was to show, celestial always shows a higher, always implies a higher kind of nature. So it meant to say that he would be over them also in terms, higher than them, in terms of his intellectual, his direction, his ethical and intellectual perfection, that they would seek this from him. He would rule over them in that way also. Of course, as you know, the brothers weren't too pleased to hear these dreams, and it's interesting. Their response was, they said, what they said was that, they said in verse 8, they said, will you, I don't know which translation you're using, but over here the Hebrew is important because it sounds like a redundancy. Probably in your translation it would just be the same thing again. Amalo, will you rule over us, or will you or will you reign over us? Now there's a difference really between those two phrases. The first one is Hamoloch Timloch Aleinu, Melech, the word Melech, you may be familiar with that, Malki Tzedek. They have the word Melech, it means a just king. So the first one was that they said, will you be a king over us? And the second one was, will you rule over us? Now there's a difference between a king and rulership. In the prophets you have, it says that the kingdom is to God and he rules over the nations. Then it says on that day, in the day of the Messiah, that God will be a king over the entire world. Now, why does it separate? At first it says God is king, God has the kingdom, and then he says that he rules over the nations. There's a difference between kingdom and ruling, and the difference is that a king is always appointed. See, a king must be appointed. If you take a look at Maimonides, you'll see that or in Samuel, actually, when the people asked for a king, see, a king must only, there's no such thing as a self-proclaimed king. King has to be appointed by the people. As a matter of fact, in Deuteronomy, where the Torah mentions the commandment proclaiming a king, so it says that the people will say, I want a king like the other nations. So there's no such thing as a self-proclaimed king. That's why, by the way, the idea of Jesus being king of the Jews is an absurd idea, because he can only be a king. He can't be a king in name alone. There's no such thing. In other words, kingdom has to be a reality where the people appoint a person and recognize him as a king. If he's not appointed, he can't be a king. He can't be a self-proclaimed king. Other institutions can be, do not need the people. For instance, a Kohen. A person is a Kohen whether the temple is in existence or whether it's not in existence, as you well know. That's dependent upon simply the fact that he is defined by lineage as a Kohen. But a king must have kingdom in reality. The people must willfully accept him. So what the brothers said to him was, which one of these two do you really expect to happen? Do you expect us to appoint you as a king? Is that what you say your dreams mean? Or do your dreams mean that you will rule over us by force? You see? And that's why that explains the verses in the prophets as well. It says the kingdom is to God and he rules over the nations, which means to say that the nations don't accept him. He is a king because the Jews accept him as a king. But he rules over the nations because they don't accept him. But then it says that on that day, which means the day when the Messiah will come, God will be a king over the entire world, which means all the nations of the world will recognize God as king. Then he will be a king, only when he's appointed by the people. So that's the verse is not a redundancy. It's two different concepts. They were approaching him, of course, critically, and saying, which one of these two are you suggesting? Now, the story continues. That the story says that the brothers were jealous of him, as you know. And what happened further was that the brothers, because of their jealousy, at first they wished to kill him, as it says in verse 18, that they planned to kill him when they saw him come from the distance. And you have to understand that here we're speaking about, and this is something which the oral law constantly stresses, and that is, you cannot look at these people as just ordinary people. To think that they were just vicious people, even in a regular family, an ordinary family, people would not kill a brother if they're jealous of him. So this just doesn't make any sense. You'd have to have a very wicked person that would want to do something like that. And yet the Torah describes these people, these great people, as wishing to kill Joseph. So we have to understand what that means. After all, they were raised by the best teacher they could have, which was their father Jacob, one of the patriarchs, the last of the patriarchs. So they couldn't have been wicked, evil people. Why did they really want to kill him? And what kind of a justification could they possibly have had? So if you take a look at Genesis 37, it states that, in the beginning it states, that Joseph, it says verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was, well, there's several translations of what follows, but Unculus, I'm following Unculus's translation, he says because he was a very wise son. The word zaken is used to indicate wisdom. Others say because he was born to him. He was born to him when he was older, but whatever. And nevertheless, it says that, and this I can tell you is a part of the oral law, that whichever interpretation you use, the fact is Rashi says that Jacob taught Joseph all the Torah that he had learned by Shem and Aver. Okay, that's Shem and Aver both had a Shem was the Malki Tzedek. And they had a place of learning where they taught the people, and Jacob had spent a number of years there studying under them. And this Torah he gave over to his son Joseph. Now this Torah, it doesn't mean he didn't teach his other children, but in Torah we have different levels of knowledge. And the most basic level is to understand the laws of the Torah, the basic method of thinking of the oral law, and the basic philosophy of Judaism. But then there is hidden metaphysics. Metaphysics is like the vision of Ezekiel, or the vision of Isaiah. Those things, when you read them, you realize right away you don't understand what they mean. Now, these are the secrets of the Torah. It means it's very deep, abstract, metaphysical ideas that not everyone is capable of studying. And I was speaking with David this week, as a matter of fact, about the fact that people love to study Kabbalah. We have a law in the, which is a tradition among our people, part of the oral law, that one is not permitted to study anything like Kabbalah or deep metaphysical philosophy until one is a thorough scholar in the law, in the overt law, in the law that a person can understand, and is not that hidden or abstract. Because what happens is when a person doesn't know how to think properly, he's not intelligent. The moment he starts reading these mystical things, also, he will immediately start projecting his own emotions, primitive emotions, onto the scene. And that causes a total destruction of the personality, because the person arrives at false ideas about God. And that's why people are enjoined by the oral law not to study those areas until one has reached a level of knowledge where they're not going to be subject to coming up with foolish, nonsensical ideas that just appeal to their emotions. A scholar is protected by his wisdom, that he knows when he sees something, he knows how it has to sound and it has to make sense. So what the Torah is telling us here is that Jacob felt that this son Joseph, as young as he was, had something about him that he was able to confide in him the true secrets of the Torah. And it wouldn't harm him because he was intellectually capable of handling it. So he taught him this, his special knowledge that he gained from Shem and Aver. And then the Bible says, the Torah says, that he made him this coat of many colors. Now, the previous verse says that Joseph brought bad tidings to his father about his brothers. Now, what the coat of many colors represented was, actually that coat indicated the fact that Jacob was really appointing a successor. And, you know, there's always in the Sanhedrin, you have a Nasi, he's the leader of the Sanhedrin. And over here, of course, the patriarch and leader was Jacob. Now, what Jacob did was, during his lifetime, he appointed the one, by giving this coat to Joseph, it wasn't just a nice coat. I mean, they were grown men, and they certainly wouldn't be envious of a coat. But the coat indicated that he was going to be the one that takes over. He was going to be the authority, the ruler, the one that makes the decisions after Jacob passed away. Now, the brothers noticed that he used to bring bad tidings back to his father about them. And the brothers had to make a serious judgment there. Their judgment was that our father is making a serious error. He is being fooled by his young son. He thinks that he is really a prospective leader, when in fact he is nothing of the kind. As a matter of fact, if he were to be the leader, then it would mean destruction to the entire group. Because here we had these 12 people that were establishing the tribes, and this was the foundation of the whole of the house of Israel. And to have the wrong leader would have been the worst possible thing. And therefore, what the brothers determined was that he really is out to destroy the whole system, because he brings bad tidings from one to another, causes strife, and therefore they said that he must be removed. So at first they planned to kill him, and but we'll see. Before we get to that, I just want to I'll try to take it in order. What happened was, it's very interesting. You take a look. You have to read, as Rabbi Soloveitchik always says, you have to read between the lines in the Bible. Now, after he told the brothers about his dream, so it says in verse 11 that they were envious. But the father kept the thing. In other words, he took it seriously, but he didn't overtly. He tried to actually dissuade Joseph from this kind of talk. As it says in verse 10, it says, his father got angry at him, and he said, "What is this dream that you dreamt? Shall I and your mother and your brothers come to bow down to you to the ground?" Of course, the key word in that verse is your mother, because she had died already. And that's why Jacob was saying that this dream cannot be true, because in the dream, the number of celestial bodies would have to be the sun and the moon. The sun was the father, and the moon represented the mother, and then the 12 stars represented the brothers. So Jacob said, "You see, this dream cannot be true, because your mother is dead." So it's obviously nonsense. And he got angry at him, but then in verse 11, it says that his father kept the thing, which means that in his mind, he realized that there is something to this dream. He just tried to dissuade Joseph from displaying such kind of arrogance. Now, it's interesting. You see, it says that the brothers went to, they took the flocks to pasture in Shechem. And then it says that Israel, Jacob said to Joseph, he says, your brothers are with the sheep in Shechem. He says, I'll send you out to them. And then it says that Joseph answered, "Hineni, here I am." Now, hineni, the word hineni, Rashi points out, the oral law points out, that hineni always means, it conveys two notions. Here I am means it conveys humility, and it also conveys the fact that I am ready. That word hineni has two implications. You can't translate it. You have to translate it by two concepts. It's a certain humbleness, and also humility. I am here. and I am ready to do it, which implies that he knew, as Rashi says, he knew his brothers hate him. In other words, by that time, at first he wasn't aware that they would hate him, because, you see, he came running out to them to tell them the second dream. He said, listen to the dream, and then he came and he said, in verse 9, he says, behold, I dreamt another dream. He was so excited, he thought they would share in his happiness. But apparently, when his father rebuked him, he started to think about it, and he realized that he made a mistake, and that the brothers hate him. Now it says the father sent them to go check up on the brothers in Shechem. And then you have this kind of mysterious verse 15. It says, a man found him, and he was blundering in the field. He was lost in the field. And the man asked him and said, who are you searching for? And then he says, I'm searching for my brothers. Where are they? And then the man tells him where to go. Tells him where to go. Now, Rashi says, when it says that the man found him, so Rashi says this man was the angel Gabriel. Okay? And Gabriel is mentioned in Daniel 9. Now, the reason why Rashi says this, what Rashi means by the fact that it is Gabriel, he doesn't mean it was not a human being. But he means there's a certain, again, when the oral law, the scholars of the oral law read the Torah, they have a certain sensitivity to the text. Because it's a strange story here that we find. What does it mean that he was lost in the field? It means he was off the road completely, lost in the field, wandering in the field. And then this mysterious man says, who are you searching for? So what the oral law is trying to teach us on this point is that really Joseph knew very well by this point that his brothers hate him bitterly. And that's why he says, hineni, means I'm ready no matter what to listen to what my father says. But under, down deep, he knew this is a dangerous mission. He'll be all alone with his brothers. The father's not there. And he was really afraid. And what happened was that what would happen psychologically to a person is that if a person doesn't know his directions very well and he has resistance to going to a particular place, what happens is very often he gets lost. The reason why he gets lost is because he simply is resisting the going, because there's something inside him that does not want to go. This is really what happened with Joseph. What the oral law, what the Midrash and Rashi is trying to teach us is that had it just been left to the laws of nature, Joseph would have gotten lost, he would have decided, I can't find them, and he would have returned back to his father. But then there was this mysterious man that was there. Of course, it was a human being. But when it says it's an angel Gabriel, what it means is that this person didn't just happen to be there by chance. But this was preordained by God, that this individual had to be there to give him directions. Because on his own, he was in a bitter conflict with his own emotions. And the emotions of not to go would have caused him to get confused as he was and then eventually give up the trail and go back home. But God didn't want that to happen. So therefore, God made sure that a person was there who gave him directions. And then, of course, once he had directions, he had no excuse and he had to go. So that is the idea of the Midrash, really. And if you look at the verses, a Midrash has, as I always say, a Midrash has no value unless it opens up and fits into the verse. It gives, when you look at the verse carefully, you see that it opens up the idea, like in this case, where you see he's wandering in the field. Strange kind of statement. Why is he's off the road completely. He's in a field wandering. What is he doing there? And the answer is that obviously that he really was resisting and he couldn't find his way. So therefore, he would have gone back, were it not for the fact that God preordained that he continue, because through the intervention of this person who was, because of divine providence, at that place, just at that time, to give him directions. Okay, now it's interesting. First it says that they wanted to kill him and throw him into the pit. Of course, they felt he was an evil person. He was actually, there's a halacha that says that, you see, you have to realize that this is before the law was given. So before the law was given, the way that the brothers lived was according to the philosophical law. And the Torah says that a person who is an individual, that the oralos states, a person that just goes from one to the other bearing bad tidings is considered the worst, most evil individual. Actually, he forfeits his that's what he does. He constantly forfeits his whole place in the world to come. Because it means that he lives on aggression, verbal aggression. And in man, everything a man does, practically, his instincts are all translated into the verbal. So when people, we don't take it lightly in Judaism. If a person talks against someone, it's considered a very serious matter. Because it indicates the fact that his energies are, he may not be killing the person with a knife, but he's destroying him verbally, which is just as bad because all his aggression is being directed to the verbal outlet. But an individual that is constantly, we call it a Baal Lashon Hara, a person that constantly talks against another person, that's what he thrives on, is really worthy of death. I mean, his life is worthless. So the brothers got together and they had a kind of a Beis Din, and they determined that he is a truly evil individual and his life is worthless, and therefore they were going to simply remove him from this existence. And it was a kind of philosophical judgment. It was different than after the Torah was given, because after the Torah was given, you can't operate on a philosophical level. You have to follow the system that God gave. But they lived on a philosophical plane because it was before the Torah. And they determined that philosophically this man's existence is worthless. So therefore, we might as well remove him from his misery, so to speak. And then, however, there was a change of heart. Reuven said he tried to save him. He said, no, we shouldn't kill him. Shouldn't kill anybody. Then he threw him into the pit. And the next thing we read is that they sat down to eat, and they saw the caravans. And yes.
On verse 20,
yes.
In our translation, you alluded to it somewhat, but you didn't go into detail.
Right.
But in verse 20, the last phrase says, "We shall see what will become of his dreams."
Correct. Yes.
Now, is there not an indication there that there is, they do believe that there is a possibility, or is that a derogatory statement of saying that, well, he's dreamed this, but we're going to overrule?
Okay. You have a very good sensitivity for the text, because Rashi and the rabbis do comment on that verse. I didn't mention it, but you're correct, because it doesn't seem to fit in. They said, now we will kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say an evil animal ate him, consumed him. And then the statement says, and we'll see what his dreams will be. It doesn't make any sense. We'll see what his dreams will be. Of course, once he's dead, he's not going to fulfill any dreams. The rabbis give a strange answer for this. They say that this verse was not what they said. They say that this verse is what God wrote. In other words, the prophetic voice. This verse is interjecting here a prophetic voice, and the prophetic voice is saying that you think that you're going to kill him, but we will see what will happen with his dreams, implying that the dreams will really prevail. That's the interpretation given by the rabbis. I didn't mention it because it still bothers me as to that interpretation, because it is too far away from the literal, and I don't fully understand it. As I said, I mean, you know, there are many, many interpretations in Midrashim, and we know, as Nachmanides says, we're not obligated to take every interpretation. But what you do with an interpretation, you don't fully understand it, sort of keep it in the back of your mind, and then one day you may gain insight from another area, and then suddenly you see that it does make sense. But at this point, I'll just give you what Rashi says it means, that it's a prophetic voice, so to speak. They didn't say that part. That's a prophetic voice that was interjected. We will see what will happen to his dreams. We will see, in other words, who is right. Will his dreams come true, or are you going to be right? But as I said, it takes it out of the literal context too much for me to feel that I fully grasp what the Midrash is saying on that point. But your point is well taken. It's a good question, and it's a text that does stand out as very strange.
Okay, we have another question here,
yeah.
And I'll put a little comment on it. This is the way I've looked at that one before.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of look at it from the fact that these brethren said, we'll put him in a pit so that some wild animal can eat him. They were just going to leave him, not kill him and leave him in the pit, but they were going to put him in the pit to just see if God would deliver him.
Well, if you take a look at the verse, it says, and we will say an evil animal consume them. It doesn't say that we will let an evil animal consume them. That was their plan. The plan was they had to say, they had to answer the father, back to the Father. They had to say something. So the literal translation of the verse is, and now let us go and kill him and throw him in one of the pits, and we will say that an evil animal ate him. So again, you know, you're going to have to change the literal. I hate to do that. As you know, I mean, I really feel that one must be faithful to the text and simultaneously read between the lines and see the full depth of the Torah as well. It's not, they're not contradictory. When there's a conflict, there has to be explained. I would have to think about that Rashi more. I don't at this point really fully understand it.
Okay, we've got another comment here by Miss Deborah Revis, who's not working tonight. She's getting it in. So here's her statement.
Mm-hmm.
Put it on your head and then
we'll... It's really a question. When they were justifying slaying him,
yes.
You said they were living by a philosophical level?
Correct.
What about the seven laws of Noah, which forbids murder?
Okay. That's an excellent question. The Noahide law does forbid murder. But, you see, it would appear that the sons of Jacob were actually on a higher level than just the regular seven laws. And they were living close to God on a very philosophical plane. And because of that, they felt that they can mete out philosophical judgment, which means that if a person is in fact, his existence is worthless, that there is nothing wrong with removing him from this existence. Now, what right they had to think that way, I cannot say, because that was an unusual situation. It was a situation where you had people that were basically under direct contract, so to speak, with God. They weren't just like the B'nai Noach general civilization was a civilization. So apparently they felt that they have the right to mete out judgment on a philosophical plane. And again, I mean, we can't do that. In a regular court, we can't do that. In a regular court, a person's existence may be worthless, but only God can remove him from this existence. But they apparently felt that they can live on a philosophical plane and mete out judgment on a philosophical plane. But, you know, I mean, that's what we see from their actions. Whether they were authorized to do that through a prophecy or something, I mean, I don't know. I cannot go beyond that point. I can only go up to that point and say that was the way they were thinking. Okay. Now it's interesting. They don't seem to be. They don't seem.
Rabbi,
to be go-
yes. Excuse me. If we were to look to the Torah for examples of how we are supposed to live today, is this a good example for us?
No, absolutely not. We can't do that because we are bound by law. Once the Torah was given, we are bound by fixed law, and we can't operate on a philosophical plane anymore. That's out of the question. We have to follow the laws that God gave us, which are systematized. And we can't say, well, this individual's life is worthless, let's remove him from his existence, unless he does a violation, which the Torah says warrants death. But now it's a legal system, and the system must be upheld. So, as the rabbis say, the rabbis many times in Talmud say that a person's certain individual's life was worthless, and and as a result they died. God killed them, but they wouldn't. They couldn't execute a person like that. It's a philosophical judgment that we can't impose anymore. But apparently, before the Torah was given, the system was working on it in a different way, with these people who are on a very high level. And they were operating on a full system.
David was making the point that in the past we have been able to deduct from the text of the life of the patriarchs examples of the Mene Noah concepts that they were practicing in here, it would appear that they are in direct violation of the prohibition against the shedding of blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the point she was making.
I understand the point. It's a very good point.
Okay.
But I can only say, as I said before, that they felt that they were authorized to mete out punishment since philosophically his life was worthless, and he was a threat to the whole future of the nation. I can't go what... Now, your question is, what right did they have to break the form of the law? There's the spirit of the law, and then there's the actual form of the law. And I can only answer within the framework of the spirit of the law that such an individual they felt was worthless, and therefore they could remove him from his existence. But what right they had to break the form of the law is a good question. I can only say that it would appear quite clearly that they felt that they had a right to operate, to function on a philosophical plane, and to mete out judgment in this case. You'll see they changed their minds in a moment, but at first that was their first intention. It's true, we do learn from the patriarchs about the B'nai Noach laws, that they kept the B'nai Noach laws, but here you have a case where it's true that they were breaking the law insofar as the letter of the law is concerned, but it wasn't a breach in the idea of the law. In the Ben Noach courts also, they mete out judgment, and as a matter of fact, there are those that say that that's why Simon and Levi killed the whole city of Shechem. What right did they have to kill out that entire city? And they say because the son of the king actually kidnapped Dina, and kidnapping is punishable by death, and that's why they were justified in doing that. But and the whole city stood by and didn't do anything, and they were obligated also. That's what Maimonides says, because they had an obligation to set up courts, and if they didn't do that, then they were subjecting themselves to the penalty of death. Nachmanides happens to argue on that point. But in general, it is true. We do deduce the laws of B'nai Noach from the patriarchs because that was pre-Torah. But in this case, for some reason, they felt that they have a right to operate not by the letter of the law, but by the spirit of the law. What their justification for that was, I can't say. I mean, sometimes when you're studying Torah, you know, you can go up to a certain point, and you can't go any further. We could just define what they were doing. But your question would be, well, what right do you have to go by the spirit of the law and to negate the letter of the law, the structure of the law? It's a good question. I can't answer that question. But it wasn't that they were violating the law totally. They felt that they justified operating on this plane. We, of course, cannot do that after the Torah is given, the law is fixed. At that time, apparently, they felt that that was the proper way to handle the situation because they were involved in establishing the nation of Israel, and they felt they were above the general system that was given to B'nai Noach, where it's just the letter of the law, but they felt they could go beyond that into the spirit of the law. Well, your question is, how could they further justify it? I cannot answer that question. I could just go up to this point and show you what their thinking was. But you are right. It would be nice if we could ask them, you know, how they knew that they could violate the letter of the law. Okay, do you follow what I'm saying?
I think we pretty well have that down. And what I would say in addition to that in the earlier part there, contemplated murder, in our judicial system today you call that conspiracy, mm-hmm. to commit murder, but yet they never carried out the act.
That's correct.
So, in actuality, they have not violated the Torah principle yet. And I have another question when you get down there. The concept of kidnapping, see, they actually kidnap him and sell him into bondage, which is also punishable by death.
Correct.
So, I mean, that's another question when you get there.
Okay.
But see, they contemplated murder. Mm-hmm. They planned murder. They didn't go through with their plan, but they did do another act that was equally as damnable as far as the punishment is concerned.
That is correct.
All right, so that's Is everybody clear? Clean? Yeah. They're ready for you to go on.
Okay. Now, the next point is that Judah comes in, that's in 26, and he says that, what gain do we have if we kill our brother and we cover his blood? Let us sell him to the Ishmaelim, that's the caravans, and our hand shall not be in him because he is a brother of flesh, and his brothers listened. Now, you see, what Judah introduces, they felt, as I said before, that they have the right to operate here on a philosophical plane and to destroy the individual who would actually be the destruction in their eyes of the whole system, setting up the tribes. And he was an evil person in their eyes. But what Judah introduced was as follows. He said that we shouldn't kill him because of the fact that he is our brother. In other words, what he was saying was that to take a life requires a more objective kind of more objective kind of group. Since we are related to him, he is our brother, and a relative really is not the best one to pass judgment. You know, in the Sanhedrin, you're not allowed to have a relative can't pass judgment on a defendant that's related to him. And the same thing as witnesses can't be related. Not like in our courts we take testimony from everybody, but in the Sanhedrin it was very strict. You could not take testimony from anyone who was a relative or anyone who was a known violator of the law or who had lied in the past, or it was a totally different system. Now, what Judah introduced was, the idea was that we have to, again, they were operating on a philosophical plane over here because they would definitely not be justified as relatives to judge another relative. But they did take the liberty, as I said, to operate within the spirit of the law. But here Judah stepped in and he said that perhaps the fact that we don't have to obey the letter of the law, but the fact is that relatives, close relatives, cannot really be objective judges because there's too much emotion involved. And therefore he said, but we're forced to get rid of this terrible, dangerous situation where there's a threat to the whole establishment of the nation. And therefore, they said that we will not take his life, but we will simply remove him from the picture. And that's why they simply sold him to the caravans and he was taken down to Egypt. His point was, again, that because we're brothers, we even within the spirit of the law, we know that a man cannot be as objective as he should be. Nevertheless, we have to do something in order to evade this tragedy. So we just should remove him, and that's it. And once he's removed, we've gotten rid of the problem. Why should we judge him personally? That's not our business. Our business is simply to get rid of the bad situation, and this will solve that problem, and we don't have to actually take his life. So he was saying, his argument was, that it's not necessary to do anything to destroy Joseph because he's an evil person. That's not our business. What we're here today for is, in his words, was just to take care of the situation. And once we get him out of sight, out of this position that he's in, then we have solved the problem. So that was Judah's suggestion, and the brothers agreed. In other words, when you see the Torah law is interesting. When a person is killed by the Beis Din, by the Sanhedrin, which, as you probably have heard, happened very, very rarely. But whenever that did happen, it served two functions. One function was to remove the person from society, and the second function was really to atone. It was an atonement for the sinner. And that's why before the person was killed, he would repent. And he would repent, and the purpose of the of taking his life was really also to benefit his soul, so that he pays for his crime and he's forgiven for his sin. It was a forgiveness, really. So what Judah said was the forgiveness aspect is not our business. We aren't really ones that should judge because he's too close for us to judge. But this is a situation which demands action. Otherwise, obviously, our whole society is going to be destroyed. And therefore, what we should do is just remove him from the scene and not judge him for his sake. Let's just judge him to take care of our situation. That was Judah's suggestion. And the brothers agreed. Okay. Now, again, David's question, of course, his question is how, what right to do that? It was a major violation. Again, you must say that they, for some reason, and again, I can't go beyond that point, but they felt that here we must operate not according to the letter of the law, but according to the spirit of the law and the philosophy of the law, which is that the man must be removed from our society. Okay, now, it's interesting that they sold him, and then they slaughtered the goat, and they dipped his coat in blood. And and it says that they, when they went to the father, they said, "Do you recognize this? Is this your son's garment, your son's coat?" And he said, "Yes. A bad animal ate him. He was torn to pieces." And it's interesting how they said to him, "Do you recognize the coat?" That was a very shrewd maneuver because they didn't want to indicate in any way that they were envious. I mean, when a person's envious of something, he makes sure to look at it very carefully. If a person's envious of his neighbor's new car, he likes to go over and eye it very well. And they wanted to remove any kind of suspicion, so they indicated, like, "We don't even know what that coat really looks like. We haven't bothered to examine it well, but you must know. Is this really your son's coat or not?" So they used psychology in the process. Now, then, of course, that's the end of that that first part of the story. Now, the story really continues later. It picks up again in where Joseph, after Joseph becomes a ruler. Okay? Now, there's one question that we must answer before we go further, and that question is this. That the brothers weren't stupid. They were intelligent people. And there's one problem they should have thought of right away. And that is that if we actually sell this young boy to as a slave to be taken down to Egypt, then there's one problem. As long as he's alive, with his life there's hope. And that could cause a serious problem. Because no matter where he is, he could just send a letter back to his father. And of course, once his father is informed as to what happened to him, then he would naturally save him. But or send a messenger to his father. Of course, it's possible to say that the brothers were very cautious to make sure that no information got to the father. That is a possibility, and it probably was true. But there's something else as well here, and that is, you see, they felt that Joseph would never even try to contact his father because they were counting on one thing. They noticed his personality, and his personality was such that he had to, the moment he had these dreams, he immediately had to go running to his brothers telling them about these great dreams and what a great person he really is. Now, an individual like that is really a weak individual because it means that he depends upon others' praise in order to have his self-evaluation. I think my wife mentioned that last week, that person that brags is really the most dependent, even though he's arrogant, but he's the most dependent person because he depends on the society to boost up his ego. And the moment he doesn't have that boost, he's destroyed. So most of the time, the people in this society that are considered to be the most powerful are really the most weak because they're more dependent on others. And if they don't have those people to constantly reinforce their ego, they simply would be devastated. Now, the brothers assessed his character, and they saw that the moment that something good happens to him, that he thinks something great is going to happen to him, he must right away run and tell everybody. So he obviously is not a strong individual. He depends totally on us for his ego support, his ego strength. Now, when they sold him, what they realized they were doing was destroying him, not just in the sense of selling him physically as a slave, but destroying him, his morale as well. because here his own family, they assume that he thinks we're really, you know, we're very excited about his dreams. But once they see that that they're really out to sell him and to that they're going to sell him and they have no use for him whatsoever, that they consider him to be the lowest person on earth, so he would be broken emotionally. Now, once a person is broken emotionally, he also becomes broken spiritually, and they felt that being sold as a slave, being sold by those from whom he sought support, and being actually living as a servant, an underling, he will break down, and he immediately will abandon the ways of that he was taught by his father to keep the Torah and to his relationship with God. And what's going to happen is that he's going to abandon that kind of a life, and he will never even try to approach his father. Because once he does that, he will feel so, he will be so guilt-ridden, and he will abandon the whole way of life, and that will really destroy him. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, they were wrong, because they made a false assessment of Joseph. Joseph was far stronger than they imagined. Even though on the surface he had this arrogance, but down deep he was a very strong person, as you know from the other stories. But when he had a child, you see that he said the first child, the name of the first child was Menashe, because it says, because God made me forget all my work and my whole father's household. So, let me try to find that verse. That was... yes, it's in... It's in 41:51. He called the oldest son Menashe, because God made me forget all my work, all my toil, and the whole house of my father. So you see, he was a very intelligent man. He was very successful over here. He was the second to the king. Can't get a higher position than that. Most people would be elated. They'd say, "Wow, I made it!" But he knew that the psychological is more important. No matter how successful a person is, if he is not psychologically happy, it's all worthless. And this we constantly see in our society, with the, especially in the Hollywood scene, you know, where people, you know, you see the suicides and the depressions, and in spite of all the success. Joseph was a very deep psychologist, and he knew that all the success is worthless unless you're happy internally. So he thanked God that God allowed him to forget the house of his father. So you see, that was a devastating blow. That his father's house sold him out, and they thought that that would totally break him, but they miscalculated. Of course, he was a far deeper person than they had understood, but nevertheless, the bolt, I mean, the jolt was there, as you see. Now, the story really picks up. Storyline picks up when the brothers come down to Egypt in order to get food. Now, over here, it's very interesting. Again, without the Midrash and without Rashi, we would have very little insight into these passages, but into these verses. But once they open it up, it really is quite amazing. It says, and I'm reading now 42:7. It says, Joseph saw his brothers and he recognized them. He made himself strange and he spoke harshly to them. He said, "From where do you come?" And they said, "We came from the land of Canaan."
Rabbi?
Yes.
I'd like to ask a question before you get there, and this will be in chapter 45. Excuse me, 41.
41.
Okay. Yes. And Joseph takes a wife of Potiphar's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yep.
All right. Now, if he is the progenitor or the patriarch, mm-hmm. Now, is this girl he's marrying a non-Jew?
Well, of course, there was no such thing as a Jew at the time.
I understand. That's what I'm saying. That I'm saying the question, but I should say she isn't. I'll be technical. She was not a descendant of Eber.
That's correct.
All right. So if they are following the Torah, as far as not intermarrying, you've got him intermarrying here, and of course we know the story later, Moses intermarries.
And then you have Judah also before.
And Judah intermarrying, but here one of the great patriarchs is marrying a non-Jew.
Right.
And, there's not a whole lot said about it.
That's correct. Well, the only time you find that,
okay, well, I'm gonna come out and then you explain.
Okay. Yeah, it's true. The only time you find that, there was a restriction, you don't find it by Moses, you're correct, you don't find it, here, you don't find it by Judah, was by Isaac and by, Jacob. That's an interesting point you're making. That's the only time you find that restriction, that they shouldn't marry the Canaanites. After that, there was no such a restriction. I can't say why. Apparently it was only the patriarchs that were not permitted to intermarry with those other nations. But later, it would appear that it worked on an individual level. In other words, if the individual was a good person, that's all that was required. It wasn't required that they should have the origin. The origin should be from a particular group. Perhaps, in other words, they just judged the individual by what the individual was. It is interesting because you see, Eliezer really had a daughter. And the rabbis deduced this from a kind of a slip that he made in the Torah, where he instead of saying maybe, which is ulai, he says elai, to me. And the rabbis say that was a kind of a slip because he really wanted to have his daughter marry Isaac. And what Abraham said was, no, that can't be, he says, because my son is blessed and you are cursed. And the blessed and the cursed cannot intermarry. Now, you have to understand, Abraham was the kindest man in the world. And Eliezer, while he came from Canaan, was one of the greatest individuals that ever lived. Nevertheless, Abraham said that we can't have this marriage. The reason is because the patriarchs were archetypes. And the nation always identified with these three people. As a matter of fact, the strength of the Jewish nation is, and I mentioned this before, that the philosopher, founding philosophers are separate, and then you have the nation. Over here, the philosophers were the progenitors. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they were the philosophers of the nation, they were also the progenitors of the nation. And the reason for that is because that gave tremendous psychological strength to the nation throughout, by the fact that they united by these parent figures that are their parents and are their philosophers and thinkers. So whereas you have other great thinkers in the world, they weren't successful because when ideas go against you, you tend to, you know, rebel against them. But when it's your father, it's your forefather, and you have that kind of an identification process, you really, it's much harder to go against them. And that was one of the arguments that Moses used to God, when God said that I'll make you into a great nation. So the rabbi said, Moses said, if a table of three legs can't stand, how could a table of one leg stand? Which means that if you destroy them and I become the one that the nation stems from, the nation is just going to trace itself back to me, one person. That's not good enough. This way the nation traces itself back to Jacob and then Isaac and then Abraham, and the three is a very important thing, a psychological factor, to give the nation that strength in order, in times when they don't understand the law and they want to rebel, but this keeps them because of the fact they know that they have this common parentage, which were really the thinkers, and they have to take pride in these people, and that pride, while it's not really the ideal state of the Torah, the ideal state of the Torah is a person doesn't have any pride, but we have to work with psychological means as well. And I would say that that's the reason why only these three couldn't marry outside of a specific group, because then it would sort of dilute the perfection of these people. People tend to judge others by where they come from. And I say, well, so and so. I mean, yeah, I'll speak from the Jewish standpoint. Like you have people that that come from called Galicia. You know, they call them Galicianos. So you know, you have different people say, well, I wouldn't marry a Galciani, you know, or Hungarians, Hungarische, they say. And people are, of course, it's prejudice, there's no question about it. But that is a human reality, unfortunately. And apparently, God's system demanded that there shouldn't be any negative kind of association to the patriarchs. But though, of course, those are the three pillars that the nation identifies with. Afterwards, people don't really know too much about Joseph's wife. They don't even know her name or anything. Whereas the matriarchs, we all know their names. So it wouldn't serve such an important, it's not really that important. The main thing was that she was obviously a very fine person, a fine individual, and she was judged on the basis of her individual character. Same thing with Moses, who married the daughters of Jethro, from Midian. And he wasn't the founding father of the nation. So this restriction, it would seem, was in God, because God felt that in the models you shouldn't have anything that is negative. That's actually what Abraham said to Eliezer. He wasn't putting him down. He was just saying, you're a wonderful person, one of the greatest people, but nevertheless, here we're trying to build a nation that's based on a psychological, that's going to be based, he knew from prophecy, on this very strong psychological bond to the three patriarchs. And in that area, we can't have any negative kind of mothers of the nation. And that's why they came from that family, from the seed of Aver. That's what I believe the reason is. But the restriction was not a universal restriction. Okay? Where are we standing here?
We're waiting for comments from the peanut gallery, and we don't have any yet.
Okay, I can go for
And I don't think we're going to have time because we only have about 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Less than two, right, Don? Less than two. But, you know, this is always a subject right here when you start talking about, quote, mixed marriages, unquote, and the genetic pool. And I can understand what you're saying about, Abraham being very specific about where the bride of Isaac was to come from. And yet we find that, and I'll accept what you say about that, but the others were lax in this. And then the post-synaptic rule, they got real strict again.
They got strict again once the Torah was given?
Yes, after Sinai.
That's absolutely. The reason is because then you're dealing with masses of people, and you just can't. Once there's going to be a break in the masses, they're not going to. They're just going to. It becomes halacha there. You can't. You have to have a system. You can't operate on a nationwide scale, without a system. Whereas before, it was an individual scale, so it wasn't a problem. Each one chose the proper person, to the best of their ability. And even Moses, according to some, Moses married an Ethiopian. Some rabbis say differently. It doesn't really mean literally an Ethiopian, but Rashi says. But there are interpretations that do say that. But that was because it was before the system. Before the system, it didn't matter.
All right, Rabbi, we got about 30 seconds, so we'll cut off on that one.
Okay.
And we'll pick back up next week.
Okay, we'll continue next week.
All right.